Hello and welcome to the next episode of the Enterprise Doctor Business Show. My name is Mark Harris and I am the Enterprise Doctor. I do mentoring and coaching for small businesses. And I really am pleased that my guest today is Steve O'Connor, who is the director at the River and Rowing Museum in Henley. How are you, Steve?
I'm very well, Mark. Thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
Good. It's really my pleasure. And our paths have crossed before. Even though I live and work based in the dreaded word Marlowe, forgive the bad language, but I am a member of the Henley Business Partnership, which is very welcoming to businesses from outside Henley. And there's a once a month networking event called 3FM, which stands for Third Friday of the Month. And over the life of that networking event, it's been based at a number of different places. And I really am happy to say, no disrespect to any of the other places we've been who may be listening, but your place is lovely. You've got a lovely big room with sunshine streaming through the windows in an ideal world, and great catering for the coffees and croissants and baps and stuff in the morning, and a good rooms, good tables, good chairs. Really, I guess maybe I'm doing your pitch for you, but I do recommend it as a venue. So let me start really by asking you, apart from that big meeting room which 3FM uses, tell me about the River and Rowing Museum. What is it? The name is reasonably explicit, but tell me from your perspective, what's the point? What does it do? Who does it attract?
Well, I suppose in its simplest terms, we're a museum that focuses on three areas. So we talk about the River Thames, the small rowing, and the town of Henley on Thames. But really, the museum itself is much, much more than that. And you've alluded to it in that amazing intro on the Thames room reviews for the 3FM meeting. So really what we're trying to do is place the museum at the centre of the community. So as well as the galleries that tell incredible stories of those three really important areas, we also have an event space, which we're filling up. We have a brilliant cafe run by the guys at Velo Life. I'm sat in our what we call Building 2 affectionately here, which is office space that we rent out to local business, as well as working with local schools, as well as being active when it comes to environmental issues on the river. So really, the museum is a gallery, and that is the main sort of physical center of what we do. But hopefully it becomes much more than that. It does become that hub around which the community of Henley and the community around Rowan and the river starts to circulate in the coming years.
And in all seriousness, where better in the country than Henley to do that? Henley has, and again, with no disrespect to anywhere else that has rowing events, but Henley has one of the biggest rowing events in the world, happens outside your door. So it does seem to be a very appropriate space for it. And in terms of people who visit, I can't not comment on the naming of Building 2. And I'm going to give you some absolutely free of charge, proactive advice. Change the name, come up with something attractive for Building 2 that says what it does. Because, you know, it's important to get the word out there. If you named it as something as the Henley serviced office space or whatever, it would make people go, ooh. So enough of that. Who is it who comes? Do you have an idea of the demographic? Because I'm guessing lots of Henley visitors and Henley schools, and clearly anyone for whom rowing is a part of their life, if you're in that part of the world, they're likely to come in and visit. Do you attract visitors from further afield?
Yes. So we know that the museum last couple of years has had not the best time, and certainly our numbers have dropped off post-COVID and post a long-term closure to complete lots of building works. So the numbers are starting to rise back up, and we know that approximately two-thirds of our visitors are young families, and we know that the other third are what we call independent visitors, so older people that are intentionally making the decision to come and visit and, you know, are interested in the galleries themselves and the collection we have on display. So the plan is to grow the market with both of those groups, because we know they're sort of our core visitors. You know, we've got 12,000 people in Henley. We've got half a dozen primary schools here that we can work with. And we know we've got the rowing plan, if you like, that will come down and look at what we've got. But then we're going to target people within an hour's drive of here, because we think that the awareness of the museum is actually quite low. So if you compare us with our local competition, for want of a better word. So people like the Museum of English Rural Life or the Story Museum or the Ashmolean, people will be aware of those things, but not necessarily the River and Rail Museum. So we're going to focus on those two core markets, but try and drive market awareness across the locality within an hour of it. And then over the next couple of years, one thing we're really keen on doing is trying to open up to markets that don't normally come to museums. And so, you know, the obvious one is older teenagers. You know, there's a attendance at museums, it can be, if you're drawing it as a graph, it's like a big smile. So, you know, when you're very young, you come to museums, and then as you get older, you don't go to museums. And then as you get slightly older again, you start going back to them. And across the museum sector, getting the teenage groups to engage with museums is really difficult. And I'm not even sure we're going to be able to crack it, but I really genuinely do believe we should have a go, and we should document the process, and we should share our learnings. We dipped our toe in the water just a couple of weeks ago when we had a Henley College takeover day. So half a dozen of the students came in and started to run various functions. So they ran project management, they took over our social media, and they worked with the curators. And it's brilliant. And, you know, so many of them are saying, gosh, we've never been here before. What a great space. And so I think it's important that documenting how we work with those groups, I think, will be fascinating and a really interesting case study. I don't think it will particularly move the dial on our ticket sales and admission numbers, but I think it will start helping, you know, move the story forward in terms of how you open museum space up to those groups.
I love the idea of that takeover day. I think it's great. And I do agree the impact of one day like that on ticket sales, and certainly the immediate impact, is likely to be next to nothing. In terms of brand awareness, all of the students who were there that day, as you just said, they didn't really know about the museum beforehand, and now they do, but more importantly, their friends do, their class does, their parents do, their extended family does. Yeah, by having 6 or 8 or 10 students in there, you probably reached hundreds and hundreds of people and made them aware of what it is. And I would guess they went away having had a very positive experience, which means they're going to be speaking very positively about you and the organisation. And I think you and the organisation is something that I wanted to move on to. You've come from the world of business into this third sector organisation, a charity. How has your experience in the world of business influenced the way that you're running the River and Rowing Museum?
Well, if I go way back to coming out of uni, I was lucky enough to get into a graduate scheme with Diageo, so world's largest drinks manufacturer, and a you know, incredible training scheme and you know, tons of opportunities. And if you really wanted to, you could go all over the world selling various drinks. So it was a really good start, and I'm really grateful I had that, because it just gave me a good grounding in business, in how to operate, and just to sort of see under the bonnet of a large PLC and see how they do what they do. And then whilst in there, marketing was the thing that really appealed to me. And I suppose, yeah, the reason I went to Diageo was because there was brands there that I had an affiliation with, Guinness being one of them, for various reasons we won't go into now. So I was always struck with how a brand can hook you, and you can be loyal to a brand, which is odd really, because if you think about features and benefits, actually there's probably much better products out there, but people will buy I always talk about people buying a pair of Nikes, not because they're the best trainers, but because they're Nike. And so that was always interesting to me. Then I went to work on for a couple of larger agencies in London with a focus on digital marketing, but way back before Facebook even had an ad product, so way back in the dark ages. And, you know, it was great. I really enjoyed that, but I actually realized that I didn't really enjoy the corporate world. I found it anyway very, very political, and I struggled slightly with not being bought into the vision of the particular companies I was working for. And so I realized fairly early on in my career that actually I need to buy in to why I'm there. I need to have a reason to come to work that I really agree with. So, you know, I think where I was at, approaching late 20s, I was still rowing a lot myself. I was a club rower. I was doing lots of rowing admin, my local club, when I was at work, and sort of on the slide trying to, you know, do various emails and bits and pieces. And so I'd made the decision to I'm young enough that I could make the transition into being a full-time coach and just try. I'd spent so many years thinking about rowing and being involved in rowing and realizing the corporate world wasn't for me. I thought, well, maybe I can take these skills and apply it in the world of rowing. So I got a job as a full-time coach. So that was working for a local authority. So went from private sector over to local authorities, worked at a boat club in Wandsworth for 5 years, ended up running that site. And then at the end of that time, Fulham Reach Boat Club came along, which is the charity I've just been running. And so I got the opportunity to set that up and take all the skills from private sector and then local authority and coaching and put that into setting up this new charity in West London, which the idea was we're trying to work with underrepresented groups throughout London and get them involved in the sport out onto the River Thames and really open up a sport that's traditionally quite hard to get into if you're not from, you know, one of the traditional schools as a young person. And so, yeah, that was great. And I did that for 10 years and it was, you know, an amazing journey to start something where I was literally given a set of keys and a boathouse and told to get on with it. And then ended up with, you know, a team of about, I think, 10 full-time staff, 25 part-time coaches, £1 million a year turnover and, you know, various awards and a couple of thousand people a year going rowing. So it was great fun to be able to run that, great fun to lead it through COVID, weirdly enough, and out of COVID, and take all those skills now and start to run the museum.
That is such a good story. And following the flow of what you just said, it all makes great sense. And I can see how one thing led to that, which led to that, which led to that, which put you where you are today. But if you go back to that young graduate at Diageo and said, how do you see your future? There's not a cat's chance you'd have predicted that you were going to be where you are today. And that's what I love about the looking back, is you can see how the pieces of Jigsaw fit together and how that flow was so natural, but you couldn't possibly predict it. So that is lovely. What I really like is the business grounding that then led you via local government into the third sector. So for me, the real purpose of our conversation is what I wanted to explore is the similarities and the differences between running a charity and running a business or being involved in the running of a business. And for me, the obvious first thing is that a charity is not all about the pound's profit.
Absolutely. Yeah. We're about the social change we're seeking to affect. And that's what any charity should measure itself on. And you're absolutely right that the for-profit sector is exactly that. It's aiming to make a profit and, you know, provide shareholder return. Whereas what we're trying to do is measure our impact and measure ourselves against those social criteria that are set out in our articles. Having said that, we can't achieve that the social impact we want to see if we don't make a profit or what we call a surplus. Because I think the main difference I've seen between the for-profit and the not-for-profit sector is there is a real visceral emotional reaction when you start talking about profit in the charity sector, and particularly when you start talking about overhead, which I think is absolutely fascinating, because the reality is that if all the numbers on the spreadsheet continue to be red, at some point in the future you won't have a charity anymore, so you have to make those numbers black. And so I think that's probably one of the reasons why the trustees appointed me to take this on without having an arts background, because you know, previous directors have been incredibly well-versed in the museum sector and in the curatorial process and all that goes along with that, but possibly haven't necessarily, you know, run something before or had a business background. And so I think what I bring to this is the fact that whilst I don't understand the curatorial process, although I'm learning, it turns out you can't just pick a boat up and move it. You know, there's a process you have to go through. I've had my knuckles wrapped already. But I do understand the subject matter of the town of Henley and Thames. I've lived here for a while. You know, I've been on the river since as long as I can remember, and I've been involved in the sport for nearly 30 years now. So I understand the subject matter, but I also understand that as a charity, we have to set ourselves up in a way that we generate a surplus and we cover our costs, and that all activities we run, we don't just run them because of the social impact. We run them starting with the idea of social impact, and then very quickly we back it up with how we're going to run it, and we ensure that our finance team are involved at the very early stages, along with our marketing team and whoever else, so that every piece of activity we do is thought through as a project and is measured not only on impact but financials as well. So we ensure that we're not actually setting ourselves up for failure by running activities which lead to more losses and more losses and more losses. What we're trying to do is cover all of the costs along the way. And if we generate a small surplus that we can put back into reserves, because as a charity, you know, we don't have shareholders, all the money goes back into the charity, so much the better, because it means that we can then drive further impact further down the line. So yeah, it's fascinating. I think there's a bit of work for me to be doing internally with the team to bring them around to that way of thinking, so that everybody understands they all have a part to play when it comes to turning those red numbers back over to black.
Yeah. I have worked in a range of ways with a number of charities. My business is called Enterprise Doctor, and it's not called Business Doctor for two reasons. One is there's a franchise called Business Doctors, and I didn't want to join that franchise, no disrespect, but that wasn't the route I wanted to go. So obviously I couldn't call my business Business Doctor. And I thought, well, I have a track record in the world of education. I have a track record in the world of charities. So those are all different enterprises. Bingo, Enterprise Doctor was formed. Unfortunately, if you Google Enterprise Doctor, you find a lot about Mr. McCoy, who was the doctor on the Starship Enterprise, which is not to the benefit of my business, but hey, such is the way. So I was going to ask, well, I completely support everything you said about the need for the numbers to be black. And I have a view that not all the numbers need to be black. There may be some projects which you knowingly run at a loss and the numbers are therefore red on that project, but actually the project is for the greater good, whatever that may be. It ticks boxes that your articles say that you should be achieving XYZ, and it means you're achieving those things, but you're not achieving on the financials. And for me, not only does that not matter, that's brilliant that you are able to do those things at a loss, but the other things, or at a lack of surplus, what is a lack of surplus at a loss, but the other things that you do, like, for example, the cafe, the car parking charges, the room hire, whatever else it may be, entrance fees, wherever you get revenue, so long as the surplus on those things is greater than the loss on the other things, then the final number on the spreadsheet, which is actually the only one that really counts, the final number is black. Does that chime with the way you're approaching it?
Absolutely. And one of the areas we're setting up now is breaking everything down into projects. I don't think it'd been done particularly well before. So for example, you know, we have, as you mentioned, revenue generation. So car park, cafe, ticket sales. We then have our education work. We then have our care for the collection work. So all those are broken down into their own discrete project. The overhead is allocated to those in a certain way. So if you add them all together, you get the total number of business. But you're right in that not everything has to be operated in a surplus. So for example, education for us is hugely important as an accredited museum. And we will always educate young people, and we will always run programs with schools. And from this charity and my last charity, it's incredibly difficult to charge the schools the full cost of what it takes to teach a child on site. You just can't. Like, I know the school budgets and they won't cover it. So that program on a purely invoice basis will run at a loss. So without fundraising externally or without the cross subsidy from other revenue generating areas in the museum, that, you know, the whole thing will be a loss. But if we can get those cross revenue surpluses going in, we can get fundraising coming in, then it covers itself. But you're right, there are certain things we set out to do as a museum that we know will need support in the future.
There's a real skill in balancing the benefits of surplus generation against the benefits of education or other aims that you might have. So if somebody approaches you with a, hey, I've got an idea, or if one of your team comes up with an idea or whatever, and you do the numbers, but it is going to lose X pounds, but the benefits for the community, for your educational aims, whatever else, are clear, how do you go through the process of quantifying the intangible benefits and then balancing those out against whatever number X may be? So if one student is going to learn a little bit about the river and it costs you 10 grand to do that, then clearly that's not a good sum. And if 1,000 students spend 5 days there and it costs you a pound, that is a good sum. But neither of those examples are realistic. It's clearly somewhere. So how do you go about having that ethical conversation?
You do it exactly like that. It's a conversation. And I think for those projects, you have to judge it on an ad hoc basis. So as you know, the person in charge, anyone that's run something before, you know that there will be some things you run that on paper don't make sense, but you just know they're right. And you know that they will have a longer term impact. So it goes back to what I was saying about brand building. Yeah, there's a lot we can do that in theory, won't make sense if you just look at the hard facts on why we're running it, but we know it will have a longer term impact throughout the community. So, you know, there are certain partners we work with across the town where we you know, host them and we look after them. And actually, we don't make any income from that whatsoever. And we could be using that space for revenue generating activity. But actually, there's been a conversation decision had that says there are wider term benefits and longer term benefits, which we don't necessarily quantify, or we can't necessarily articulate, but we have a sense and a feeling that they're there, and which I guess comes from experience and you know, having done this for a while, that it's worth running. But it, for those things where we're not quite sure, or we think it'll be a loss, but we think there's a spin-off benefit in the future, it really has to be done on an ad hoc basis, and it has to be talked through with the team so that we've covered off all of the potential perils and pitfalls, balanced it with what the potential benefits are, and then ultimately it's for me to make the call on whether we're going to do it or not.
Yeah, and in many respects, those are the things that you're actually there to do. You're not there to make money. The making money bit is to fund those other things. So I just wonder, do you sometimes get to the point where you say, okay, this is going to cost us $5,000 and there is benefit to it and we'd love to do it, but the $5,000 hit on the bottom line is just too much? Do you then shrug your shoulders and walk away? Or do you perhaps say, okay, how can we reduce that $5,000 loss? Can we get some sponsorship? Can we do it in a different way? Can we cut costs? Can we do whatever?
Exactly that. As you said, the second part of that is exactly where we go. So to be honest with you, the way the business is at the moment, most things we do aren't going to generate a surplus. So we're having these conversations constantly about, okay, well, how do we get there? How do we make it work in the long run? So a great example is next year, we're looking to run an exhibition to support the Olympic Games and the Paralympic Games, which are happening in Paris in July and August. And so we're going to run a temporary exhibition on Henley and the Olympics. So the fact that, you know, Henley has hosted two Olympic Games in its past, we've got tons of athletes in the town that have taken part in the Olympic Games. I'm very pleased to announce that Sir Steve has said that we can have his medals on display during those 2 months. But the reality is it's going to cost us money to put that together and, you know, get all the right display cases in order and get the right projectors up and, you know, all the marketing around it. So we know we want to do it. We know it's going to happen. As I sit here today, we haven't got a funding plan for it. So we need to go out and find sponsorship and get people involved. So that's one of those examples where it, on paper, it doesn't make sense. We know it's going to make loss. We'd be better off sitting on our hands and not doing anything. But actually, we know we have to go forward and promote the exhibition and run something alongside the Olympics. And so we're taking that leap of saying we are going to do this and we will find the sponsorship to make it happen. And if we don't, you know, that's a failure on my part, and I'll have to front up to the trustees and explain where it all went wrong.
I had my doubts that you will need to do that. I think you'll get there. I find it interesting, and I don't know if it was a slip of the tongue or just an unimportant word to you. So you did just refer to the organisation as the business, not the charity. Is that how you think of it?
Yes, in a word. It is a business. We are an incorporated business and, you know, we have to think, operate and behave like a business. You know, I think the old fashioned view of a charity sort of living hand to mouth and scrapping to get bits together in order to see the next week or month, that is a good way to exist for certain organizations, but not for this organization. If we, you know, we've been here for 25 years, if we want to be here for another 25 years, we have to think and operate like a business. That doesn't mean that we're acting purely for profit, not at all. That's not our motive. Our motive is social impact and social change and telling incredible stories that inspire our visitors. But in order to carry on doing that, we have to operate like a business in the background.
I really could not agree more. I fully support what you've said. I fully support what you're doing. And I wish you every success for the future. You have a fabulous building. If anybody, what did you say, an hour's drive? If anybody within an hour's drive of Henley or further, if you feel the need, I really would recommend visiting. It's a great place to go to. And I think that that's probably a really good point at which I say thank you so much, Steve O'Connor, for talking to me today. Steve is the director of the River and Rowing Museum in Henley. I hope you've not found this too much of a chore to chat today.
No, it's always been great. Thank you so much for having me.
Good. Really been my pleasure. And I look forward to seeing you at the next 3FM meeting. And at that point, I will say this is Mark Harris, Enterprise Doctor, signing off.